Live from legendary Music Row in Nashville, Tennessee, Larravee Guitars proudly present two guys fumbling their way through the music business so you don't have to. It's Scott and Hino and the Music Row Show.
Hello, friends. Welcome to a special second anniversary of the Music Row Show, brought to you this hour by Larravee Guitars. My name is Scott.
And I'm Hino. Thanks so much for tuning in tonight. This show is for all you songwriters and performers and musicians out there across the country trying to find your path to success here in Music City.
No, we don't have any answers.
You know what? Not even after 2 years.
We're out slinging songs at night just like you, but we are able to find the right people, bring them into the studio and pick their brains, answer your questions.
Yeah, and you know what? If you've emailed or called in the last 3 months, tonight's the night. Tonight's the night we're going to get to see who wins that brand new Larravee OM model guitar.
I cannot wait.
I know.
I cannot wait, because, of course, as we just said, it's our 2-year anniversary. Happy anniversary, Hino.
Aw, back at you, Scott. You know what? We are celebrating in style tonight. We've got a true legend of the Nashville music scene, Mr. Ricky Skaggs. But before we get going, why don't we take a few minutes to talk about this hour's title sponsor, Larravee Guitars.
Well, Hino, Larravee Guitars was our first title sponsor.
Yeah.
I remember when we first started broadcasting, we were really struggling to pick up our first couple of sponsors.
Yeah.
But, you know, even though we were anxious to find one so we could, you know, stay on the air,
yeah, we
were also very committed to making sure that we were endorsing something that we really believed in.
Yeah, you know what? We actually had interest from a couple of other guitar manufacturers, and we ended up not pursuing that because we really didn't like their instruments.
Yeah, there was no way I could sit on this mic every week and say, hey, play this guitar that sounds like a toy.
Like a toy, yeah.
Yeah. No. So, you know, and that's really why we were so excited when Larravee came on board, and we're thrilled that they've stayed with us as a title sponsor this past 2 years. We love the guitars. I play mine every day. We respect the company. We look forward to many, many more years of spreading the word,
yeah,
about the amazing tone and quality workmanship in a Larravee guitar.
You know what? When you're ready for a new guitar, take the time, you know, go out, play everything else out there, but make sure you play a Larravee. Put that on your list. Check out all the models that they have to choose from by logging onto their website, which is Larravee.com, Larravee.com, or you can always find them on our website, themusicrowshow.com.
And by the way, I don't know if you've checked it out yet, but they've completely redone their website.
I did see that.
It looks very cool. So check them out, Larravee.com.
All right, Scott, it's time. Please do the honors.
Absolutely. Well, this is an exciting night for us. Ricky's been at the top of our wish list really since we started doing the show 2 years ago. I remember actually sitting there making the list, and there was a few on there, and you've been on there ever since.
Wow. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for being here.
Glad to do it.
In a town that's, I don't want to say jaded, but it's jaded. I mean, we're spoiled with an abundance of just amazing musicians.
Great talent, yeah.
In this town. And
Whole Foods is full of...
It is. My barber can really pick like nobody's business.
That's true, he can.
But what's, you know, anytime you say Ricky's name, people just shake their head and say, man, he's real good. All right, that's...
They shake their head all right.
They do. They do. Sometimes like this and
sometimes
like that.
I can't believe that guy.
But they shake it. you know, Rick's carved a legacy as an instrumentalist, a recording artist, an entertainer, a composer, and really one of the true good guys in the industry. He's played music with everybody.
Everybody.
I mean, I was telling my wife, no, everybody. I was thinking about it. Anybody can possibly think of Bill Monroe, check. Jack White, check. James Taylor, Boston Pops, Elvis Costello, Fish, check, 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 check. You get the picture. And tonight he's in the studio with little old us, and what a great way to celebrate our second anniversary. 14-time Grammy Award winner, CMA Male Vocalist, CMA Entertainer of the Year, multiple-time IBMA Award winner, Ricky Skaggs, welcome to the Music Row Show.
Great to be here. Sorry that I made you wait so long. Gosh.
No, this worked out because our first anniversary, we had Rodney Crowell, who was a member of the Hot Band.
Mm-hmm. And I followed Rodney.
And you followed Rodney. So second anniversary.
Next year
we need Emmy Lou, so we may need your help on that.
They haven't kicked us off the air by then, yeah.
Yeah, let's see. I'm trying to Barry Tashin followed me into Emmy Lou's band, so maybe you can have him on sometime.
We'll have to call Barry.
Yeah, you know Barry. Barry's a great singer and songwriter. He and his wife, Holly.
Okay.
Yeah, they've got a...
Barry, if you're listening,
irritation.
Yeah,
come on.
Give us a call.
Come on, Barry.
Well, for a guy who, I've heard you say you were just trying to make a living making music.
Put my kids through school, and now that they're through school, I'm just trying to make my building payments.
You seem to be doing okay. I love the fact that your latest project goes all the way back to the beginning and celebrates the man who gave you your love for music. So tell us about that man.
Well, you know, I've done a lot of tribute kind of things. Keith Whitley and I, when we were 15 years old, we were starting to work with Ralph Stanley. We'd met Ralph, and we did our first record, the first album that Keith and I did was called Tribute to the Stanley Brothers. Mm-hmm. And so we both knew a lot of Stanley Brothers songs, and when we met, that was the one thing that really united us together was the love for that. And then all through the Bill Monroe time, especially when I came out of country music, when I went into country music, I wanted to try to, you know, have my audience, the country music audience that was starting to get turned on to my music, I wanted them to know who Bill Monroe was. And so I was always trying to include him in things that I did, you know, and CMA award shows when I would be on, they'd always want to have Mr. Monroe, you know, be a part of anything I was doing. I had him in a video, Country Boy, you know, and he played my Uncle Penn that came to New York and to you know, because I had got above my raisin. And
was another song, Uncle Penn.
That was a big song for me. And but this time, and I'll set this up even more. We've just come off of our 14th Grammy for a CD called "Honoring the Fathers of Bluegrass," 1946 and 47, and that was the 2 years that Bill Monroe had Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs in his band, and Chubby Wise, the great fiddle player, and Howard Watts, bass player, that went on to work with Hank Williams Sr. But so I've honored a lot of people in the music in my music life and career. But never really got to honor my dad as much as I have on this record. This new CD that's coming out is really a collection of songs that really predates Bill Monroe, predates, as far as my knowledge of Bill Monroe anyway. This was my first memories of music, you know, period. Songs that my dad sung, songs that he and my mom would sing together. Songs that he taught me, things that he, just really imparting to me a love for music, in general. And had he not, I guess, imparted to me these old country songs, these old mountain songs, spirituals, I wouldn't, you know, have the love for traditional music like I have today. Mm-hmm. And so this is a great tribute to him. And I kind of did it as something almost for my family, you know, especially my nieces and nephews. You know, my dad passed away in 96, and, you know, they're always talking about Papa Hobart, you know, and Uncle Rick, have you got any old, you know, have you got any old tapes of Papa, you know, and, you know, I've got them, but who can find them? You know, I don't have them logged or chronicled anywhere, but anyway, this is something that, you know, I thought my kids and grandkids and nieces and nephews would really love and appreciate. And so I hope they do. Because when we first started out, I told Sharon, I said, Sharon, if this sells 15 copies, I'll be happy, you know. And she said, well, I think you're going to be surprised how people's going to really take to this. Because the real cool factor about this is just how simple, you know, and dressed down, you know, this music is. It's just really, you know, much of it is two instruments, mandolin and guitar, or fiddle and banjo, or just maybe one guitar, or maybe even one banjo. So it's real, really, really dressed down, very, very simple, and just a pure mountain stream is really where it came from.
Wow. And now this is a true solo project, because you play every instrument on there, right?
Yeah, played everything on it and sang all the parts. And there's no real like trios or quartets or big, you know, big vocal choir type things or anything like that. I didn't go crazy like that. But there's two songs in particular that I probably added a whole lot more instruments than what me and my dad did together. Because there was two songs, one called City Four Square. That's an old song he used to sing, a great gospel thing he used to sing. And it's kind of, I guess if I had been able to have gotten my dad in the studio and said, Dad, why don't you just take your guitar and just lay, you know, just go in there and sing, and then I'm gonna build a track around your, you know, your singing, your voice. Mm-hmm. That's how I would have liked to have done it. It's kind of like Iron and Wine meets Ralph Stanley or something like that. Right. You know, it's it's just really funky and just real, very earthy. You know, I used a banjo, an old gut string banjo, and I used used an electric, you know, baritone guitar. And then some percussion, I used piano, did some things. And so it's just real, real funky sounding, you know, but it just really makes the mood of what I think my dad would have thought that was pretty cool.
Piano.
Yeah, well, you know, don't get all excited, Bruce Hornsby. nobody coming after Bruce's job, so.
All right, well, let's take a break, and when we come back, we will hear a song from the CD, and I'd like to talk about you getting that first mandolin when you were 5 years old. So
all right.
We're going to be right back. You're listening to Ricky Skaggs on the Music Row Show. We'll be right back.
Back to the Music Row Show, brought to you this hour by our good friends over at
Larrabee Guitars. That's right.
Jinx, you owe me a Coke now.
Larry who?
Here, have this one.
Yeah, there you go.
Drink a
that
bit.
Was a little bit of Country Boy we were just listening to, their brand new version. Too.
Now, that was a little different version that I'm used to.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, Cracker Barrel came to us a few years ago and wanted us to do, you know, a record for them. And they wanted us to do, you know, of course, we've been playing bluegrass since 96, 97, when yeah. we came out of country and came back into bluegrass. And what I wanted to do, and they liked the idea once I explained it to them, I had wanted to do bluegrass versions of our number one country hits that we had.
Neat.
And
yeah.
so we did Crying My Heart Out Over You, You've Got a Lover, Heart Broke, Honey Open That Door, Uncle Penn, Highway 40 Blues, things like that, you know. And but we did bluegrass versions of them. And so what you heard was the bluegrass just nasty version of Country Boy. It's just, I mean, and it works so well with, you know, with the bluegrass,
sure.
the banjo and the acoustic guitars and everything. So it's really cool.
Man.
Wow.
Well, just before we went to break, Scott mentioned that you got your mandolin at an early age. When did you get that? When did you start learning how to play?
Well, my dad was, let me back up. My dad had a brother. His name was Okel, O-K-E-L, and he and my dad, when they were kids, they played and sang together. My dad played guitar and sang lead, and my uncle played mandolin and sang tenor. So they had this brothers duet thing, you know, just around home. They didn't do anything professional at all. But Okel was a few years younger than my dad, and so he had to go into the war, World War II. And he was in 1 year and 1 day, and they stormed the beach at Guam, and he was killed.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
And so really, just my dad just, you know, it just killed him. You know, my dad, and so I think my dad made kind of one of those inner vows, you know, that if I ever have a son that shows any interest in music or any kind of musical, you know, talent whatsoever, I'm going to get him a mandolin, and you know. Maybe he'll learn to sing tenor and, you know,
right.
can have this thing that was taken away from me, you know. And so when I was 5 years old, I'd been singing since I was three,
mm-hmm.
according to my mom. We used to sing in church, and my mom would hold me up in her arms and or set me on the pulpit of the church, you know, and I would sing harmony with them. And,
harmony?
Her and my dad. And so I could sing the part that I remember her singing with my dad, which was the third above the lead, which is the tenor, you know,
right.
what we called it. And so one morning in the winter, my dad was a welder, and he was working out of town. And he came home, and I found this mandolin on my bed when I woke up,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it was a little old, short, you know, a little small thing. But that instrument became my first love. I mean, it became just instantly, I just bonded to it, you know, and he showed me the basic male bass, little three chords, G, C, and D, you know, and showed me that. And then he got snowed in for a couple of weeks up in Ohio and couldn't get home from work. He couldn't get home. And so when he did come home, I was playing mandolin, changing the chords where they were supposed to be changed as I was singing, you know, and flipped him out, and he, you know, he went and bought a new guitar, and you know, we started just when he would come home on the weekends, that's all we did was sit around and play and sing, you know,
right.
So it was a great way to grow up, and he had such a love for this music, and really those songs that I heard him sing, you know, during that time is what's on this record, this solo record.
Well, what's interesting, I was watching another video of you talking about your dad, and not only did he get you into playing, but really you got him back into playing because his guitar was somebody else was using his guitar, so he had. He'd walked away from that, so it was really a mutual thing where you two really brought that music back to each other, right?
Really did, and you know, he and my mom would sing in church, but sometimes they'd just stand up, sing kind of a cappella, you know, and didn't even use the guitar. But once he got the guitar, then we started playing as a family more,
uh-huh.
you know. But it did. It kind of sparked his love for music again. He just kind of. Got a newfound love in life again, you know, with his music. So it was a mutual thing, you know.
Right.
But we had, oh God, we'd have 15, 20, 25 people over on the weekends, you know, to play music and the cool thing about my dad that I really loved is when I was, you know, when I was 6, 7 years old, 8 years old, he was introducing me to old fiddlers and old banjo players that was 70 years old,
right.
75
mm-hmm.
years old, you know, and so really I got to learn and really, I guess this honoring thing really came, much of it came down from my dad because he loved old people. He just loved the wisdom of mm-hmm. elders and always taught me to respect them, you know, and not talk back to them, not be a smart aleck, you know, and to really honor what they had done. Didn't matter if they were good or if they were bad, you know, whatever, you know. And really the scripture says, you know, honor your father and mother that your days will go well with you. Of all the Ten Commandments, the only one with a blessing attached to it, if you will honor your father and mother, then I will bless you.
Right.
And so there's something to that. You know, you kind of have to humble yourself, kind of come under in order to honor somebody and lift them up. You know, it's mm-hmm. not always about you, you know. And so I think God appreciates that and loves that about us when we honor others bigger than ourselves, you know, because it does. It makes us have to come under to do that. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, it's especially hard to do when you're a kid, too, because when you're a kid, you know everything, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
all parents are idiots to kids sometimes,
know.
You know.
You know, and what I couldn't believe after I got married and left home, I could not believe why my dad wasn't teaching college somewhere, you know.
Really?
Because here was this man that I used to think didn't know, you know, diddly squat, you know, when I was a kid. I was such a smart aleck, you know. And then I realized, this guy's a prophet. Everything he ever told me about my life has happened, you know. And he used to say, son, you won't have a lick of sense till you're 40. And then when you're 50, you might know something, you know.
Uh-huh.
And of course, he always said that as a joke. But it's true, you know, when you're young, you think like you're young, you just, it's just when you get older, you start realizing, you know, life ain't so, you know, all those things ain't so important, you know.
Right.
Family is what's important. Relationships are what's important. Your relationship with God, you know, and the gift that you've been given is just really a door opener to do good things with, you know. My dad was such a great guy. I mean, he didn't talk about being a Christian. He didn't talk about going to church so much. He just lived it. Every
right.
day of his life, he was just an honest man. He lived his life. The neighbors, you know, if someone's stove, you know, broke in the middle of the night, or if some old woman, you know, if her gas went off because it was cold or something like that, they'd call my dad, and he could fix anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd get up in the middle of the night, put his overalls on and a coat, and go crawl under a floor, you know, with a torch or something like that, you know, and thaw somebody's gas lines out, you know, and help. He's just a great person that way.
Now,
I've never done that.
I was about to say, did you get that gene too? Like, can you fix anything?
I just send somebody to a hotel.
There you go.
Hey, here's a credit card. Yeah, Just
well. On that note, why don't we play a tune from your new CD?
That's right. What are we gonna hear?
What would you like to play?
You know, one of the first songs I ever remember hearing him sing is the first song on the record, "Foggy River." It's just a cool tune, and I'm not sure who even did it. It could have been Carl Smith. It could have been Clyde Moody. You know, I'm not sure really who recorded this song.
Well, let's
first.
Hear it right now.
Now, real quick, is that the first song you did on the TV show too? Was that Foggy River? Or am I mistaken?
No, you mean the Flat and Scruggs thing?
Yeah.
No, that was the Foggy Mountain Boys.
Foggy Mountain.
That was the name of the Flat and Scruggs band. Well, no, I did Foggy Mountain. It might have been Foggy Mountain Rock. That might have been, that actually, it was an instrumental, yeah. Yeah.
That's okay. We'll edit all this out.
Right. Didn't Foghat, were they involved in this
live,
somehow?
Right?
This
is
Hog
Slow
Fat,
Ride, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear it.
The bluegrass version was Hog Fat.
Your love is colder than a foggy river, flowing o'er a heart of stone. You left me stranded on this foggy river, drifting helpless and alone. Can't escape this broken heart of mine. There's no freedom anymore. Heaven help me on this foggy river. Help me find the distant shore. This foggy river, everything I love is gone. I always knew someday you'd let me down. I've got troubles on my mind. Yes, I'm doomed to sail this foggy river. Yes, I'm doomed to sail this foggy river till I leave your love behind.
And we may have started to allude to this, but I was watching your TV debut on the Martha White show at 7 years old, and I don't know how to say this, but that's just not normal.
No.
I mean, you weren't fooling around. You were so serious and
did
intent.
You see that face and
yeah.
those eyes.
You were just you were intense.
It's amazing. When I see that back, I flip. I can't believe that that I was that focused.
And, and that didn't even, that just came from you, right? I mean, nobody forced that on you or anything. You just took it that seriously.
You know, here again, my dad introduced me to all these people,
right.
So he had made friends with Mr. Bell, the backstage guard at the Ryman for the opera. They'd made friends. And so Mr. Bell would let us come backstage if we, behave and not, not be messing around and, sure. you know, asking people for autographs and pictures and all kind of, which we wasn't into that much. But anyway, one night I was back there playing mandolin just by myself. My dad didn't even have his guitar with him, but he, you know, I had to take my mandolin. It was like, the, you know, it was like the American Express card. Don't leave home without
right,
it, you know.
Right.
So I had to have it just in case somebody wanted to hear me play. And so anyway, I was back there playing, and Earl Scruggs walked by. They were playing the Opry that night. So he walked by and stood there and listened to me play and said—
and you knew who he was, of course, at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, knew okay. who he was. My dad certainly knew who he was. And so he and my dad met and started talking, and he said, well, I'd like for you to bring your son down for an audition for our television show next week. So that's where all that happened, is because of my dad. My dad was just someone that he never met a stranger. And I can't say he was a networker that just kept notes on everything and
right.
said, okay, now I need to call this guy. Or I mean, this was before the internet. This was before cell phones. This was
sure.
before everything, you know. And so he was – he just – would always be in the right place at the right time. I mean, it was amazing how he was able to, you know, to get in and out, you know. And,
yeah.
Well, that's amazing, because we had Stan Hitchcock on the show mm-hmm. a month or two ago, and he was talking about how he actually had to hide the fact that he was going to go do music from his parents, because when they found out, that it was just like the world had ended. You know, no,
yeah.
don't
yeah.
do that, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it doesn't sound like you had that at all. They encourage you to go on and
they
pick
did.
It up as a career?
They did, and I think my dad knew that I had, you know, a real talent, and that if I wanted to try to pursue it and really try to stay with it, you know, that I could make it, you know. And I think that was his heart, was to see me, you know, get on the Opry. I mean, that was really the main reason that we moved to Goodlettsville when I was, you know, 7 years old. My dad, you know, was took a job in Paradise, Kentucky at the TVA plant down there, you know, the atomic energy plant down there, and was welding and stuff. And so he never liked being too far away from the family anyway. So he just decided that, you know, we would move the family to around the Nashville area and try to get me on the Opry.
Man.
And I was too young to be on the Opry. I mean, there was, I'm sure there was child labor laws and stuff at that time, you know. That
Well, didn't they turn you down at first because of your age?
Yeah, that's what we always heard, you know, that they said, well, he's just too young to be on here, you know. And so huh. I don't know. But anyway, you know, my dad here again was someone that he knew where to be somehow. He just had a sense of knowing, you know, where to be at the right time. And he was such a friendly person, you know. It's hard to say no to him, you know.
Right.
Too. And,
so doing research and reading up on you, Ricky, there's that. And then in your teens, you run into Keith Whitley, and I want to talk about that too. But there's 8 years there. Musically, what were you doing there from 7 years old to 15 years old?
Well, I was really trying to get better at mandolin. I had picked up the guitar as well.
Yes, you did.
and then I when I was 13, I started playing the fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, was getting pretty good at that. I mean, it was the fiddle and mandolin, the left hand is the noting is the same. I mean, although you note down here with mandolin, you note up here with
right.
fiddle, it's still the notes are the same as far as where you put them on, you know, into the thing. It's there the tuning is in fifths. But the bow is what was the weird, you know, weird thing to try to accomplish. And my dad was introducing me to some great fiddle players there in Eastern Kentucky, a guy named Sanford Kelly, a guy named Paul Wright, lived in Ohio, was my cousin. Then a guy named Paul Johnson that lived in Paintsville, Kentucky, was a great, great fiddle player. But, this guy named Sanford Kelly, not only was a great old time fiddler, but he was a comedian. He was a storyteller. His family had come from Ireland many, many years ago, and he also played the banjo, played the clawhammer style banjo, which
okay.
is the old fashioned drop thumb style banjo, and that fascinated me because I liked Earl Scruggs style five string, you know, style banjo like Ralph Stanley plays too, but there was something really, really ancient sounding about that that drop thumb banjo style right. that you play with your fingers. And, you know, it's just so, as Bruce Hornsby calls it, so nasty sounding, you know, just good, you know, mountain. And so that's what I'm playing on the back cover there. You can see that, you know, that the cover on the
And this is that CD. Gut string?
That's the gut string banjo. And, boy, he sounds mean and nasty. And,
wow. So it's just, it looks mean and nasty.
I know it.
It's, you kind of look mean and nasty.
That's right. The whole thing.
Yeah, a little Paul Revere looking there with that hair. You know,
yeah. That's funny. Now,
but that's kind of what I was doing for those 8 years was learning some different instruments.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And then after that, that's when you
Me and Keith met.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we went to see Ralph Stanley. We'd been singing, you know, for maybe 6 months, Keith and I and Keith's brother. And so we found out that Ralph Stanley was going to be over in West Virginia at this little bar over there. So we had to have our dad go with us. So he took us over there. Ralph's bus broke down. And so we were sitting in the audience at a table waiting for Ralph to show up, and the club owner had heard that me and Keith was singing and had, you know, had been playing around town a little bit. So, did y'all bring your music with you? And I'm, duh. You know, that's why we bring it, just in case somebody needs it, you know. So,
just in case somebody's bus breaks down.
Yeah,
you
that's
never
right.
know.
And you never know. So we went out in the car, and, you know, he said, if y'all could play 30 minutes or so, Ralph's just a little late, you know, and the natives were getting restless, so... You know, and here's the deal. The only songs me and Keith knew was old Stanley Brothers songs. So as bad as we hated to, we were singing Ralph's songs when Ralph comes walking in, you know. And instead of, you know, him just going on back to his dressing room, he puts his banjo down and pulls up a bar stool and sits there and listens to us sing for 20 minutes probably.
Wow.
And we're freaking out because, you know, all of our instrument cases are in his dressing room, the only little dressing room there was. But anyway, that was another great meeting that my dad made happen, you know. So that night was the night Ralph really fell in love with Ricky Skaggs and Keith Whitley, and we started working in his band then right after that.
Nice.
Played for about 2.5 years in his band.
Wow. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to be back with more of our second anniversary show with Ricky Skaggs here on the Music Row Show.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. We are here on our second anniversary with the great Ricky Skaggs, and we're brought to you this hour by our friends at Larrivé Guitars. Before we get back to Ricky, I want to remind you all about Earmark Digital, earmarkdigital.com. Not only if you're a songwriter like we are, if you want to have a CDs made, they do a great job with that, but I've also used them to have my great-grandmother's 78 record of her singing the old Rugged Cross put into CD, and I've done some videos transferred to DVD. They can handle pretty much anything you need, and they can do short runs, big runs, whatever you need. So check them out, earmarkdigital.com, or look for them on themusicrowshow.com.
Yeah, and that was a tune we were listening to on the way back in called Colonel Prentice.
Yeah.
Nice tune.
Fiddle tune.
Yeah, I love that. And that's you playing the fiddle.
Me playing the fiddle and the banjo.
The yeah. banger.
Banger.
I like where you pick at banger.
You know, after some years, you went on and you started your own band after having played with Ralph for a while.
Uh-huh.
What were the challenges of not only being the performer but also the kind of the boss and the band leader? I mean, what new challenges did that bring on problem for you?
Well, after I left Ralph, I went to work with a group called the Country Gentlemen up in Washington, D.C. I worked with them for about 2 years. And had wanted to put together – Keith and I kept talking about putting a band together when we left Ralph. And it seemed like it just never worked out for him and I to ever get back together. You know, as much as we loved each other as pals, I think musical interests or just the roll of the dice, it just didn't work, you know. And J.D. Crow called me from Kentucky. I was living up in Northern Virginia at the time in the D.C. area. And he called me and wanted to know if I'd come and take a job, you know, with his band, with Tony Rice, you know, and in Lexington, Kentucky. And, of course, I loved Tony and I loved J.D.'s playing and I loved the sound of the New South. They were a great group. You know, I told J.D., I said, well, you know, I'll come and stay for a little while, but I said, ultimately, I want to put my own band together sometime, you know.
Right.
And he said, well, hey, that's fine. Just come and play and stay as long as you can, you know. And so we made one album, The New South, J.D. Crow. And then Tony went to work with David Grisman, moved out to California, and worked with him for a couple of years, made some great instrumental music. Stefan Grappelli did an album with them, a live album, and it was awesome. I finally got a chance after JD to start a band called Boone Creek, and Jerry Douglas was in that group with me, and we had that group for a couple of years. And during the time I was in DC, I met Emmylou Harris, you know, and so Emmylou was trying to, you know, get me to come in her band, mm-hmm. you know, and I just really wasn't ready to make a big step like that. I really wanted to stay in bluegrass a little bit longer, and I certainly wanted to see what it was like to have my own band, you know. I really kind of felt like I need to do this before I can do anything else. I just need to experience what this is like, you know. And so having Boone Creek was, I had three other partners, and it was really, you know, it was really different not being able to make the decisions myself, but yet, you know, I had to consult with three other guys. And I was just doing a lot of the work, and it was just – it was one of those things musically. We were, you know, I really loved the direction we were going. It was kind of a new bluegrass style, you know, that was – we were writing a lot of songs, writing a lot of instrumentals. Of course, the great dobro playing of Jerry Douglas was just such a great sound, you know, that had to open it up. Oh, man, yeah. It opened up the style. And, of course, we had the banjo, so we could do traditional, but we could take traditional songs and really soup them up, you know, with the dobro, you know. And so it was a cool thing. But after a couple of years of that group, Rodney Crowell, as we mm-hmm. mentioned earlier, Rodney decided he was going to start a band on his own and leave Emmylou. So Emmy called me again and said, hey, you're on the top of the list. You're the number one phone call. We want to know if you'd come and work in the band. So I was about ready to try and do something different. So she called it a good time. And so I decided to go with her and work in her band. That was in 78. So I worked with her in 78, 79 up until August of 1980. And then I came to Nashville with a country music career, wanting to start a country music career.
Well, your experience with Boone Creek and having to handle the business side and the creative side, I mean, what kind of challenges were there? Because creativity and business sometimes don't mix so well. Not everybody's really good at that.
Right. Well, I felt like, I knew that I had to, I mean, I was pretty much booking the shows, booking the dates, calling the promoters
So
making
kind of
the contracts. So I was doing that. I was doing, getting our hotels and stuff and just doing a lot of the work. And so I can't.
Does that kind of suck the fun out of it a little bit?
Well,
the music part?
It brings reality to it.
Yeah.
You know, when I was with Ralph, I just had to show up. You know, I didn't make a lot of money, but I didn't have to do a lot, you know, get up our own stage and play and sell records, you know, after the show. And that was kind of my gig, you know. But once I got in Boone Creek, then I realized there was a lot more work that goes into a band, you know. So it was good to get to know, you know, how the business part is done, how taxes are done and how, you know, expenses and, you know, just it was good to know, you know, to get a handle on that, you know. So as soon as I got to Nashville, I hired everybody to do that kind
to
of
do
stuff,
all that
you know.
For you. But that, that must have given you a new appreciation
well,
that when
did.
You were in other bands, what everybody did, and did it kind of change how you
looked at
it?
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. You know, I thought, man, you know, Ralph Stanley, how he has hung in here since, you know, 47. He and Carter started a band 46, 47, something like that, and how those guys hung in and how they drove cars to dates, you know, or you know, an old limousine or something like that, you know, and how hard it was for Monroe, you know, to been making records, came to the Grand Ole Opry in 39, you know, mm-hmm. and how those guys handled all of that. You know, they didn't have the modern necessities that we have today. So it really made me appreciate, you know, here again, those fathers that paved the roads that we can set our butts in a nice bus, you know, and travel down the highway. I mean, it's just like, man, if those guys could have afforded that back in those days, that, you know, they'd all be a lot younger looking, you know, today, right. be a lot more rested in their life, you know. But you know, those fathers, boy, they, you know, they went before us and they paved the way. And, you know, there were stories that I'd heard about the Stanley Brothers, you know, leaving Live Oak, Florida, when they lived down there. They had a television show down there that Jim Walters Homes sponsored. And they would leave there and drive all the way to Pennsylvania to do a date. They wouldn't even stop and eat. They just had enough money for gas to get to Pennsylvania to do a show. Then after the show, they could go get something to eat.
I mean, a burger.
That's just amazing to me. I mean, Eddie Stubbs calls that playing hungry, you know. And that's true. I mean, there was a lot of those groups in those early days, man, and their music was so authentic and so powerful because they were playing hungry. You know, they were trying to get their careers going, so they were giving it all they had. It's like it's the difference in a high school, you know, or a college basketball player that's out there absolutely busting it on every play, mm-hmm. you know, trying to get a career going for himself, you know,
noticed,
trying to get
yeah.
noticed, you know. And then once you get a $65 million contract, you know, you just kind of...
Then you're kind of walking
yeah.
across the court
yeah,
sometimes.
Or let somebody walk you across
yeah.
the court. You
That's
know?
What happened to me when I got my
$65,000. Yeah,
$1,000. Really. What is that?
Yeah.
As the ball boy?
Yeah,
hey,
really.
We're going to be right back. You're listening to the Music Row Show. Stick around.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. Brought to you this hour by our good friends at Larravee Guitars. That's a little Ricky Skaggs we're listening to there from his new album, Solo, Songs My Dad Loved, which I believe drops what?
September 15th.
That's a little song called Pickin' and Caroline. That's some pretty good banjo playing there.
Thank you. Banjo.
I like where you pick that banjo.
Banjo.
I'm curious. We're going to move back a little bit again, and I'm sorry, but then we'll move forward. You talked about playing with Ralph Stanley and J.D. Crowe, and I'm just curious, what lessons did you learn from those guys that you still carry with you today? I mean, are there things that you find yourself doing on stage that you learned from back then and from watching those guys?
I remember I was playing really trying to stretch out as a mandolin player. I felt like I'd gotten a really good job with Ralph, and I was trying to really learn the mandolin. Because when I come to work with Ralph, I'd been playing fiddle more than mandolin. I mean, I started out on mandolin, but I'd kind of laid the mandolin down and was playing the fiddle more since from about 13 on to, you know, I was with Ralph at 16. But so I was kind of trying to learn the mandolin again, or try to put some more emphasis on it and learn some more stuff. And so I remember, you know, I'd taken a solo on one of his tunes, and he leaned over, you know, and said, "What was that you played?" You know, and I said, "Well," he said, "Now," he said, "if I'd heard that just by itself, I would have not known what song you're playing," you know. And then I realized, he said, "You know, I think you ought to really think about when you're taking a solo that you play the melody, because, you know, if that's all that anyone ever hears of that song, they'll know how the melody goes, you know." And so I learned that, you know, and I think about it today too, because really, and you go back and you listen to Django Reinhardt and Grappelli, and you listen to the jazz guys, you listen to almost anybody. The first solo that they play is pretty much the melody,
right.
You know. Then they go nuts in the middle, you know, and then they'll come back toward the melody toward the end, you know. So it made total sense. I was young and full of it, you know, and I was a hot dogging and showboating, you know, trying to get a little applause for myself, you know. And but I got in a nice way. I got humbled, you know, and it was good. But I talked to Ralph a couple of nights ago, and he'd called and left a message, and he wants me to work his festival this year. And I called him back. I said, "Do you realize that I've been calling you for 40 years now?" And he said, "Has it been that long?" You know, "Yes, sir." So,
wow,
yeah,
man.
I'm 55, and I started calling him when I was 15. So, man.
We talked a little bit earlier about the whole concept of passing it on in bluegrass music, you know, from one generation to the next. And it seems to me like that's how it's done. It's not exactly like you can go to a bluegrass school, can you?
You actually can. You actually can. There's one Levelland, Texas. There is a South Plains College, I think. And there's also a great music school up in Johnson City, Tennessee, East Tennessee State. And believe it or not, Berkeley in Boston. Now, I know it. Berkeley School of Music now offers a banjo master's course, and also they're starting a mandolin course as well, and also a course in songwriting. So Berkeley comes to Nashville, brings the kids down once a year, and they bring probably 50 or 60 kids down, and they come out to Skaggs Place, out to my studio, and they, you know, we usually do a performance for them and talk about bluegrass, talk about, you know, the how it started, you know, and why certain elements in the music work, and what makes a trio, what makes, you know, what's the difference in different people's singing style. Like the Osborne Brothers had a different style. Stanley Brothers had a different style. Bill Monroe had a different style, you know. So we go through those things, and it's like a master's course. You sit and, you know, listen to people talk and explain, you know, stuff. So it's fun, you know, but there actually is schools now where you can go and become a banjo master.
I wonder how the old-timer folks, you know, the guys who learned it on their own, feel about that sort of thing. You know, I'm sure they never, you know, were thinking about scales and modes and inversions and all that sort of thing.
They never did. You know, the banjo just kind of came up out of the South and probably the East, Eastern Shores, you know, and came over into the mountains of in the Blue Ridge and up the through the Appalachians, you know. And so, you know, it's just been in these hills for years, you know, and the fiddle has too. And so, you know, immigrants brought this stuff in back in the, you know, late 1700s, early 1800s. A lot of the old Irish ballads and Scottish fiddle tunes and that kind of stuff, they've been in these in the mountains for a couple of hundred years now, you know. And it's a cool thing, you know, to retrace those steps, you know. And I know when I was with Emmylou, we played in Northern Ireland. Or played in Dublin, Ireland, actually, and we went to this. We were invited to come to this jam session. They called it a Cayley, and they invited us to come after the show. And we got there, and it was about 20 or 30 musicians sitting in a room, playing fiddles and mandolins and guitars. And I thought I had died and gone to Eastern Kentucky. I mean, honestly, it was just like, you know, being at home. I mean, the same. Same kind of tunes, women was cooking, you know, and the kids were up dancing, and the old men were, you know, spinning yarns and singing songs, and just reminded me so much of my dad, just kind of, you know, directing everything, right. You know. So it was really an awesome thing to see, you know, 200-300 years later how, you know, it hadn't changed a whole lot.
Yeah.
All right, hey, we're up against a hard break. We are going to be right back with a whole nother hour with Ricky Skaggs, and we're going to be celebrating the second anniversary of this station actually letting us be on the air.
Go figure.
That's amazing to me. Stick around. We'll have lots more here on the Music Row Show.